Johnson during the Bush administration as human scum and a bloodsucker. Bipartisan critics pounced on Trump for his unorthodox approach to summitry. They decried the off-the-cuff way he agreed to meet in the first place, the absence of advanced preparation that normally precedes such a meeting, the fuzzy notions of what would be and was achieved, little if any of which went beyond what North Korea had been offering since 1992, the respectability, legitimacy, and equal stature that would conferred upon the North Korean leader from such an encounter, the failure to extract concessions in advance in exchange for a meeting that the North Koreans had long sought, the confusion about the meaning of denuclearization. Trump's excessive praise and flattery of his more youthful and often brutally repressive counterpart. And Trump's announcement, without consulting South Korea, Japan, or his own military officials, that the U.S. would immediately cease provocative joint military exercises, with a long-term goal of removing U.S. troops from the Korean Peninsula. Nicholas Kristof said Trump had been hoodwinked. He criticized the joint statement for saying nothing about North Korea freezing plutonium and uranium programs, nothing about destroying intercontinental ballistic missiles, nothing about allowing inspectors to return to nuclear sites, nothing about North Korea making a full declaration of its nuclear program, nothing about a timetable, nothing about verification, not even any clear pledge to permanently halt testing of nuclear weapons or long-range missiles. Others were even harsher. But many had lost sight of the big picture. The leaders of two countries that had been on the verge of a horrific war a half year earlier were now sitting down and mapping a path toward peace. Denuclearization, if achievable at all, will require trust and patience. It will not be secured overnight as Bolton had initially demanded, before being largely cut out of the process that he repeatedly tried to sabotage. Stanford's Siegfried Hecker, a former director of the Los Alamos Weapons Lab, who had toured the North's vast Yongbyon nuclear complex several times, projected it could take 15 years under the best of circumstances. And there is always the possibility that an impulsive Trump or Kim could blow the process up long before it reached fruition. But as John Kennedy said, citing an ancient Chinese proverb, while announcing the nuclear test ban treaty in July 1963, a journey of 1,000 miles must begin with a single step. Often overlooked in analyzing the factors that helped peacefully resolve the Korean crisis is the role Russia played as it has fashioned closer ties with both Koreas. In fact, of all the major players, Russia is the only one with equally good relations with both halves of the Korean Peninsula. And as the Council on Foreign Relations, Elizabeth Economy, points out, Russia has played a critical role as behind-the-scenes negotiator, spoiler, and unholy ally. This was especially true during the period when relations between North Korea and China had grown frigid. It was then, on November 27, 2017, near the nadir of the crisis, that Russia proposed its three-stage roadmap as the way out of the morass. First, the two sides would ease tensions through the aforementioned freeze for freeze, or double suspension agreement. Second, North Korea and the U.S. would hold direct talks. Third, the nations in the region would begin negotiations toward establishing a mechanism for maintaining peace and security in Northeast Asia. Not only did Russia propose such a roadmap, its diplomats engaged in a vigorous effort to see that it was implemented. Russia's engagement on the peninsula goes back many decades. Before its collapse in 1991, the Soviet Union had underwritten North Korea's economic development. At that point, facilities built with Soviet assistance produced 50% of the DPRK's chemical fertilizer, 40% of its ferrous metals, 70% of its electricity, and an even higher percentage of its aluminum. In 1990, the Soviet Union still accounted for more than 53% of North Korea's trade. During the period of maximum Soviet influence, the 1950s through the early 1970s, North Korea's average per capita GDP actually exceeded that of its southern neighbor. An astounding fact, given that today the South's standard of living may be 43 times as high as that in the North. But in the years following the breakup of the Soviet Union, Russia's new leaders prioritized relations with South Korea over those with the North, and the DPRK economy suffered terribly. By 2013, Russia accounted for only 1% of North Korea's foreign trade. Since then, Russia's leaders have begun to rebuild economic ties to the DPRK, while maintaining friendly relations with the South as part of their broader strategy to develop the Russian Far East. Russia has announced plans for a tenfold increase in North Korean trade by 2020. In 2015, Russia set up the Russia-DPRK Business Council at the Chamber of Commerce of the Russian Federation. Russia has also planned several major development projects regarding energy and transportation on the Korean Peninsula, involving both Koreas, progress on which had been stalled by North Korea's pariah status and its hostile relations with its southern neighbor. President Moon Jae-in's state visit to Moscow in June 2018, the first by a South Korean president since 1999, further solidified ties and laid the basis for future economic cooperation between the three countries. Putin and Moon committed to boosting tourism to 1 million and trade to $30 billion by 2020. Among the projects given new life by recent developments were the long-stalled natural gas pipeline connecting Russia and South Korea through North Korea, and the Northern Silk Road, connecting the entire Korean Peninsula with the longest railroad line in the world, the Trans-Siberian Railway. Moon told the Russian parliament, "Through permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula, I'm hoping that the Trans-Siberian Railway will extend all the way to the southern port city of Busan, where I grew up." But the road ahead would not be easy. Democrats continued to mock Trump's inflated claims about North Korea no longer posing a nuclear threat. Bolton insisted that North Korea eliminate its nuclear weapons and all other WMD within a year, even though Pompeo gave the North 2.5 years, and most experts estimated it would take anywhere between 6 and 15 years. Skeptics within the intelligence community leaked reports to NBC News claiming that the North was increasing production of nuclear fuel. The Wall Street Journal chimed in with a report that North Korea was expanding a missile manufacturing plant. In a classic case of dubious and highly suspicious reporting, the Washington Post headlined one scurrilous front-page article, "North Korea plotting to deceive U.S. on nuclear program." California Democratic Representative Ted Lieu, one of those who should have known better, tweeted, "Now we learn there is absolutely unequivocal evidence Kim Jong-un is deceiving us." By late August, it had become clear that Trump's victory lap in the aftermath of the Singapore summit had indeed been premature. The path forward promised to be as difficult as the naysayers had, sometimes gleefully, predicted. Part of the problem was sequencing. The U.S. demanded North Korea first take concrete steps toward denuclearization by disclosing the details of its nuclear and missile programs. The DPRK demanded that the U.S. first show good faith by concluding a peace treaty. President Moon, to the displeasure of many U.S. policymakers, forged ahead independently with his own efforts at reconciliation. But his hands were tied by South Korea's still limited sovereignty and unwillingness to definitively break with the U.S. Trump, in the midst of his trade war with China, lashed out at the Chinese for not adequately pressuring their North Korean allies. Citing insufficient progress and a hostile letter from a top North Korean official, Trump, after consulting with Bolton, canceled Pompeo's scheduled trip to North Korea just hours before the Secretary of State was set to depart. The trip, which Bolton had opposed from the start, had just been announced the day before. The following week, Mattis, who along with Bolton had insisted that North Korea make the first move, announced that the U.S. was considering restarting war games on the Korean Peninsula, an undertaking that Trump had only recently called provocative. Return to the confrontational stance of 2017, which seemed like such a remote possibility for much of the first half of 2018, suddenly looked possible, if not likely. But President Moon would not be deterred. He again met with Kim Jong-un in September and pressed Trump to proceed with the peace treaty. Trump announced that he looked forward to a second summit with Kim and, contradicting the Bolton hardliners, said that, "We're not playing the time game. If it takes 2 years, 3 years, or 5 months, it doesn't matter. He went further at a rally in West Virginia, describing the tough give and take in his first meeting with Kim. And we would go back and forth, and then we fell in love, okay? No, really. He wrote me beautiful letters, and they're great letters. We fell in love. But as 2018 wound down, negotiations had stalled. DPRK officials bristled at the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and demanded that the international community drop its sanctions. Otherwise, Kim stated in his January 1, 2019 New Year's Day speech, North Korea would have no choice other than returning to nuclear confrontation. North Korean leaders sought a declaration formally ending the Korean War. They insisted that denuclearization be mutual and that steps be reciprocal. In effect, they wanted to be treated as equals and threatened to begin building up nuclear forces if progress wasn't made. Realizing that the breakthroughs achieved by Trump and Kim could be reversed, and that a return to the dangerous 2017 brinksmanship was possible, Chinese leaders urged the U.S. to abandon its unrealistic demand for complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization, CVID, and replace it with a conditional, reciprocal, incremental denuclearization, CRID. Some wondered if the mercurial Trump, having basked in murmurings about the Nobel Peace Prize and the afterglow of his meeting with Kim, might also reverse himself on other crucial issues. They didn't have to wait long. Only days after making his latest and most provocative threat against Iran, and days before the U.S. was about to reimpose sanctions that had been lifted in 2015, Trump announced that he was willing to meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani any time they want, without preconditions. Trump was apparently taking a page from his Korea playbook of creating, in this case manufacturing, a crisis, then moving in with his own brand of personal diplomacy to try to resolve it. Again, in the Iranian case, he tightened the economic vise, threatened military action, and then extended an olive branch. Though few agreed, he believed, as did Franklin Roosevelt 7 decades earlier, his personal diplomacy could win the day. He wisely declared, "I'll meet with anybody, speaking to other people, especially when you're talking about potentials of war and death and famine and lots of things. You meet, there's nothing wrong with meeting." Before Trump's more conciliatory verbal gesture, the Iranians had begun taking steps to weather the anticipated economic storm. Iran reached out to Russia for closer economic cooperation. In July 2018, Iranian oil minister Bijan Zangane and Ali Akbar Velayati, Khamenei's top foreign policy advisor, visited Moscow in hopes of expanding cooperation between the Russian and Iranian oil and gas industries. After meeting with Putin, Velayati announced that Russia agreed to invest $50 billion in Iran's energy sector. He also had plans to visit China. Iran, which has even less reason to trust the U.S. than North Korea did not jump at Trump's offer. A foreign ministry spokesman dismissed the possibility of dialogue and engagement, given the totality of hostile U.S. policies. But some saw reason for optimism over Trump's peculiar brand of diplomacy. Former Obama Middle East advisor Ilan Goldenberg wrote on Twitter, "It's a stretch, but there is a plausible pathway for a Trump-Rouhani summit. It goes through Vladimir Putin." All signs indicated that Putin would be a player in international diplomacy much longer than the politically beleaguered and scandal-ridden Trump. Putin easily won re-election for a second 6-year term as president of the Russian Federation in March 2018. He had previously served 2 4-year terms before the parliament changed the constitution in 2008, increasing each term from 4 years to 6. Because the constitution limited the president to 2 consecutive terms, Putin served as prime minister under Dmitry Medvedev from 2008 to 2012. When Putin's 4th term began in 2018, tension between the U.S. and Russia was higher than it had been in decades. The threat of war seemed more palpable than at any time since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. Many were calling it a new Cold War, but neither America's corporate liberal democracy nor the Soviets' bastardized Marxism still existed. Now Trump's autocratic, militarized capitalist plutocracy was facing off against Putin's autocratic, militarized socialist capitalist oligarchy. The former would be as unrecognizable to the leaders of the American Revolution as the latter would be to the leaders of the Russian Revolution. While the Americans, having gotten a closer glimpse of Trumpian corruption, were expressing severe buyer's remorse, many Russians were yearning for aspects of the Soviet past. A Levada Center poll taken in November 2017 showed that 58% of Russians regretted the collapse of the Soviet Union, while just over a quarter did not. This was actually down a bit from the 75% who regretted the collapse in 2000, as Putin was coming into power. The crisis in U.S.-Russian relations troubled sober thinkers in both countries. The problem can be traced back to the West breaking its promise to Gorbachev that NATO would not expand one inch eastward following his 1990 agreement to allow the unification of Germany. Documents published by the National Security Archives make clear that similar assurances were offered to Soviet leaders in 1990 and 1991 by President Bush, West German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, CIA Director Robert Gates, French President François Mitterrand, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, British Foreign Minister Douglas Hurd, British Prime Minister John Major, and NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner. But barely were the words one inch eastward out of Secretary of State James Baker's mouth before the U.S. began contemplating ways around this ironclad agreement. By October of that year, as a National Security Council memo reveals, U.S. policymakers were discussing sending a signal to the new democracies of Eastern Europe of NATO's readiness to contemplate their future membership. European leaders, understanding Russian sensitivity, decided to proceed slowly, conducting a study on NATO enlargement in 1995 and holding accession talks in 1997. Formal expansion didn't begin until 1999. With Hungary, Poland, and the Czech Republic joining. Seven more countries joined in 2004, two in 2009, and Montenegro in June 2017. Under Boris Yeltsin's leadership, from 1991 to 1999, the U.S. ran roughshod over Russia, contributing to Russia's profound economic and social disarray, and reinforcing a sense in the West that Russia's national security concerns could be blithely disregarded. It was the frequently besotted Yeltsin, ironically, who would later appoint Putin as his successor. Putin's accession to leadership in 2000 would prove to be a game-changer. Putin initially reached out to the United States, hoping to partner in global affairs. But U.S. withdrawal from the ABM Treaty in 2002 and its invasion of Iraq the following year dashed such hopes. From there, the rift between the two nations widened. U.S. plans to build missile defense systems in Poland and the Czech Republic, and the continuing NATO expansion toward Russia's borders, exacerbated tensions. At the Munich Conference on Security Policy in February 2007, Putin repudiated the American-dominated unipolar world, with only one center of force and one center where decisions are made. This is, he said, not only pernicious for all those who find themselves outside the system, but also for the sovereign himself, because it will destroy him from inside. When Angela Merkel visited Moscow the following year, Putin explained that unending expansion of a military political bloc, in a world in which there is no longer an antagonistic enemy, is not only nonsensical, but also damaging and counterproductive. Reasonable Americans concurred with this assessment. Former U.S. Senator and basketball star Bill Bradley, in early 2008, echoing the warning issued by George Kennan years earlier, called NATO expansion a blunder of monumental proportions. He dismissed subsequent justifications by Bill Clinton and Strobe Talbot for doing so. "We kicked them when they were down. We expanded NATO. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy of certain people in the Clinton administration who are irredentist East European types, who believed Russia will forever be the enemy, and therefore we've got to protect against the time where they might once again be aggressive, thereby creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we'd really done a strategic partnership, talking about common threats over the long term, and what we could do together, because we knew ultimately Russia would be back. I mean, they did have oil even then. Imagine how Iran would have been different today. Imagine how Central Asia would be different. My feelings about the Russia thing are extremely sad. I think that we've created a problem that could have been easily avoided, and we've lost a partner that could have been enormously important over the long term, and in particular, over the issues that most threaten us today. As Bradley understood, NATO had already at that point expanded to include 7 former members of the Warsaw Pact and 3 former Soviet republics. The week after Bradley made these comments, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov called in U.S. Ambassador William Burns to make clear that Russia would not, under any circumstances, tolerate NATO expansion to Ukraine, whose geopolitical significance had been laid out by Zbigniew Brzezinski in his influential 1997 book, Grand Chessboard. Ukraine is a geopolitical pivot because its very existence as an independent country helps to transform Russia. Without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be a Eurasian empire. However, if Moscow regains control over Ukraine, with its 52 million people and major resources, as well as access to the Black Sea, Russia automatically again regains the wherewithal to become a powerful imperial state, spanning Europe and Asia. Pentagon neocons Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, and Stephen Hadley had recognized the strategic importance of Ukraine in 1991, when the Soviet Union was collapsing. Hadley recalled, "We had a view that without Ukraine, a retrograde Russia would never become the threat posed by the old Soviet Union, because of the enormous resources, population, and geography of Ukraine. So that would become an important element of U.S. policy. From a strategic standpoint, an independent Ukraine becomes an insurance policy." Trying to make sure U.S. policymakers understood how seriously Russia took this issue, Burns sent Confidential Cable No. 182 back to Washington on February 1, 2008, with the subject line, "Niet means niet. Russia's NATO enlargement red lines." Significantly, the cable had been leaked by Private Bradley, now Chelsea, Manning, and released by WikiLeaks. The West didn't listen. George W. Bush called for NATO expansion to Georgia and Ukraine. Speaking at the NATO summit in April 2002, Bush strongly supported welcoming the 2 former Soviet states into the membership action plan, as a prelude to full membership, a move enthusiastically endorsed by NSC advisor Hadley and other administration neocons, as it was by then-presidential candidates John McCain and Barack Obama. Bush saw this as a signal that these countries would also be welcomed into the institutions of Europe. Germany and France led the opposition, joined by Italy, Hungary, and the Benelux countries, who all saw it as an unnecessary provocation toward Russia, especially with Putin about to attend his first ever NATO meeting that week. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov warned that any such attempt would undermine the region's strategic stability. Peskov also pointed to multiple polls showing that fewer than a third of Ukrainians even supported NATO membership. The results of one Gallup poll, conducted in May 2008, showed that 43% of Ukrainians still considered NATO a threat. When Viktor Yanukovych defeated Viktor Yushchenko in the 2010 presidential election, Ukraine dropped its bid to join the alliance. But the damage was done. Just before the start of the summit, the respected German publication Der Spiegel explained that Russia had been bending over backward to maintain friendly relations with the West, despite palpable differences. Moscow, it acknowledged, is doing its best for the moment to find agreement with NATO and the U.S. on the controversial American missile shield plans. Russia is also offering help with the transit of non-military goods, such as food, to Afghanistan. It reported, however, that Russia threatened to recognize the majority Russian breakaway South Ossetia and Abkhazia regions of Georgia if that country was invited to join NATO. Jack Matlock, who served as U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union between 1987 and 1991, understood how differently the world looked from the Russian vantage point. He wrote in 2014, "President Bill Clinton supported NATO's bombing of Serbia without UN Security Council approval, and the expansion of NATO to include former Warsaw Pact countries. These moves seem to violate the understanding that the United States would not take advantage of the Soviet retreat from Eastern Europe. The effect on Russians' trust in the United States was devastating." In 1991, polls indicated that about 80% of Russian citizens had a favorable view of the United States. In 1999, nearly the same percentage had an unfavorable view. Vladimir Putin, Matlock continued, was elected in 2000 and initially followed a pro-Western orientation. When terrorists attacked the United States on September 11, 2001, he was the first foreign leader to call and offer support. He cooperated with the United States when it invaded Afghanistan, and he voluntarily removed Russian bases from Cuba and Kamran Bay in Vietnam. What did he get in return? Some meaningless praise from President George W. Bush, who then delivered the diplomatic equivalent of swift kicks to the groin, further expansion of NATO in the Baltics and the Balkans, and plans for American bases there, withdrawal from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, invasion of Iraq without UN Security Council approval, overt participation in the color revolutions in Ukraine, Georgia, and Kyrgyzstan, and then probing some of the firmest red lines any Russian leader would draw, talk of taking Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. Americans, inheritors of the Monroe Doctrine, should have understood that Russia would be hypersensitive to foreign-dominated military alliances approaching or touching its borders. Putin saw Ukraine as the latest in a series of betrayals by the United States and its European allies. He waited until 2015 to publicly mention that during the Bush years, the Russians had intercepted calls between militant separatists and U.S. intelligence based in Azerbaijan, proving that the U.S. had continued to support Islamic terrorists, not just in Chechnya, but throughout Russia's North Caucasus. The U.S. provided them, he alleged, not just with intelligence, but also with transport assistance. Putin brought the matter to the attention of President George W. Bush, who responded that he would kick the ass of the intelligence officers involved. But within 10 days, Russia's Federal Security Bureau, the KGB's successor, received a letter from the CIA declaring, "We have had and will have relations with all opposition forces in Russia. We believe we have the right to do this, and we will do this in the future." Putin told an interviewer, "Some people, particularly special forces of Western countries, think that if someone works to destabilize their main geopolitical opponent, which, as we realize now, in their minds has always been Russia, that this is overall to their advantage. Even I thought," he added, "that with the end of the ideological barrier in the form of the Communist Party's monopoly of power, things would change radically. But it turns out, there are geopolitical interests not linked to any ideology at all." President Obama famously attempted a reset of relations with Russia, Matlock explained, with some success. The New START Treaty was an important achievement, but there was increased quiet cooperation on a number of regional issues. But then Congress's penchant for minding other people's business when it cannot cope with its own began to take its toll. The Magnitsky Act, which singled out Russia for human rights violations, as if there were none of comparable gravity elsewhere, infuriated Russia's rulers, and confirmed with the broader public the image of the United States as an implacable enemy. Putin may have had good reason to be furious. Circumstances surrounding passage of the Magnitsky Act, which the late journalist Robert Parry considered possibly the first shot in the new Cold War, have raised a lot of questions. Largely through the efforts of U.S.-born billionaire William Browder, whose British hedge fund, Hermitage Capital Management, was once the largest foreign investor in Russia, Sergei Magnitsky has been portrayed in the West as a heroic whistleblower, who was silenced and ultimately murdered in prison in 2009 for uncovering Russian government corruption. Browder was the driving force behind U.S. imposition of sanctions on Russia's oligarchs in 2012. Russian filmmaker Andrei Nekrasov, an outspoken critic of Vladimir Putin, who has made films about the poisoning of former intelligence officer Alexander Litvinenko and the crackdown in Chechnya, latched onto the story as the basis of a docudrama exposing Russian government treachery. However, Nekrasov ended up presenting a very different picture, suggesting that Magnitsky, rather than being a crusading lawyer, was an accountant who may have aided Browder in a tax evasion scam. Browder's account convinced U.S. lawmakers, but Nekrasov felt it didn't pass the smell test. "It's difficult to pin down the moment when I thought it was a lie, a made-up story," he said, singling out his discovery that there was no sign of whistleblowing. Though the film raises many troubling questions, The Washington Post dismissed it as agitprop that uses facts highly selectively as part of the Kremlin's campaign to discredit Mr. Browder and the Magnitsky Act. The film ended up being shown in the West only at one private screening. At minimum, the entire affair deserves careful scrutiny. Despite this, Putin remained open to working with the United States where the two countries' interests aligned. In 2013, he saved Obama from a crushing political defeat by negotiating the removal of chemical weapons from Syria. Putin also played a crucial role in negotiating the Iran nuclear deal. In early November 2014, with the November 24th deadline looming, and the talks between Iran and the P5+1 nations seemingly stalled, negotiators announced that a critical issue had been resolved. Iran agreed to ship much of its vast stockpile of enriched uranium to Russia for conversion into specialized fuel rods for the Bushehr nuclear power plant. A senior U.S. National Security Council official told the New York Times that the Russians have played a very helpful role during these negotiations. They had put forward creative and reasonable ideas that preserve our objective of cutting off any possible pathway Iran might have to a nuclear weapon. The official further noted that, despite differences of opinion on other foreign policy matters, Russia has remained completely unified with other countries in the negotiations. The Russians stood to gain financially from this arrangement, but they stood to lose more from the fact that Iranian oil would soon flood the market, further lowering the return Russia would get on its oil sales. But U.S. actions in Ukraine proved more than Russia could stomach. The Americans, who had been eyeing Ukraine as a potential NATO ally for years, decided to take advantage of growing discontent within that country to wrest it from the Russian orbit and anchor it firmly to the West. Ukrainians' frustration with economic stagnation and rampant corruption made many receptive to the pro-Western, pro-democracy message emanating from the State Department, which had spent $5 billion on assistance to Ukraine since 1991, and the National Endowment for Democracy, a U.S.-funded nonprofit that had been fanning discontent and cultivating pro-Western activists for years through its 65 pro-democracy projects in Ukraine. Its president, Carl Gershman, had written in September 2013 that Ukraine was the biggest prize. He held out hope that after Ukraine allied with the West, a post-Putin Russia might do the same. Russians, too, face a choice, and Putin may find himself on the losing end, not just in the near abroad, but within Russia itself. On November 21, 2013, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych balked at signing an association agreement with the European Union, infuriating the many Ukrainians who sought closer ties with the West. The Financial Times reported that the agreement, a sweeping deal more than 6 years in the making, that would have liberalized trade and required Kiev to incorporate EU law into its domestic legal code, was seen by many EU leaders as the critical next step in a decades-long effort to spread their democratic values further into the former Soviet bloc, with the goal of anchoring Ukraine firmly in the West. Putin made a generous counteroffer to the bankrupt Ukrainians and endorsed Yanukovych's proposal for a tripartite commission, that would nurture economic relations with both sides. It was the West, not Putin, that demanded an exclusive deal. And it was the West, not Putin, that demanded the kind of austerity measures that would bring misery to much of the Ukrainian population. Putin, in fact, offered a $15 billion bailout and slashed gas prices by one-third. Protests by pro-Western Ukrainians broke out in Kiev starting on November 24th. Obama administration officials, led by Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, a prominent neocon and the wife of PNAC co-founder Robert Kagan, egged the protesters on, dispensing sandwiches, pastries, cookies, and words of encouragement. She also disparaged the more cautious approach that the Europeans were taking. "Fuck the EU," she told U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt. Not only did she call for Yanukovych's ouster, she handpicked his successor. "I think Yats, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, is the guy," she instructed Pyatt. Someone, presumably the Russians, released a recording of the conversation on YouTube on February 7, 2014. Russia accused the U.S. of fomenting a coup. By the third week in February, the initially peaceful protests were turning violent. Scores had been killed. Neo-Nazis and right sector supporters were playing an increasingly prominent role. On February 20th, violence flared again when someone opened fire, killing both police and protesters. Protesters blamed the police and security forces. Another leaked phone call revealed that Estonian Foreign Minister, Urmas Peet, believed that the snipers were part of the protest movement, not supporters of Yanukovych. Peet told EU Foreign Affairs Chief Catherine Ashton that there is stronger and stronger understanding that behind snipers it was not Yanukovych. It was somebody from the new coalition. Ashton replied, "I think we do want to investigate. I didn't pick that up. That's interesting. Gosh." Yanukovych, hoping to avert further bloodshed, signed an agreement the following day with opposition leaders calling for early elections, reversion to the 2004 constitution, and a new national unity government. The agreement was co-signed by three European heads of state. The deal quickly fell apart, as protesters, led, according to Robert Parry, by right sector and neo-Nazi militias, seized government buildings, and fanned rumors that a large cache of arms seized in Lviv by anti-government forces was on its way to Kiev. With fears of an imminent bloodbath, Yanukovych's support crumbled. Fearing for his life, Yanukovych fled the capital. Stratfor head George Friedman called it the most blatant coup in history. The United States immediately recognized the new government. Russia, on the other hand, denounced the takeover as a violent coup led by neo-Nazi thugs that ousted a democratically elected president who had just agreed to a deal for elections and constitutional means to force his own ouster. The new government in Kiev quickly showed its true colors, banning Russian as the second official language, sparking protests in the Russian-speaking regions of Ukraine. On February 27th, armed men took control of the Crimean parliament and raised the Russian flag. Within days, Russian troops stationed at the naval base in Sevastopol, the headquarters of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, seized the peninsula in a bloodless takeover, in which no shots were fired and no one was injured. Ukrainian troops offered no resistance. Crimea had been part of Russia since Catherine the Great defeated the Ottoman Empire in 1783. That ended in 1954, when Nikita Khrushchev handed it to the Soviet Republic of Ukraine as a goodwill gesture. In 2010, Russian President Medvedev and Ukrainian President Yanukovych signed an agreement extending the Russian lease on Crimean naval facilities to 2042, with an additional five-year renewal option. Under the agreement, the Russian Navy was allowed to deploy up to 25,000 troops. Now Russia, responding to Crimean popular sentiment and not wanting to risk losing its naval base in Sevastopol, took it back. On March 6th, parliamentary leaders in Crimea, who had always maintained a large degree of autonomy, voted to break from Ukraine and join Russia. Parliament set a referendum for March 16th. The results were one-sided. in an election scorned in the West, 97% of voters opted to join Russia. Russia welcomed them. Meanwhile, things were heating up in southern and eastern Ukraine, which also had significant pockets of Russian speakers who identified more closely with Moscow than with Kiev. On March 1st, the Russian parliament approved Putin's request to use troops to defend Russia's interests. On April 7th, protesters in the eastern Ukrainian cities of Donetsk, Luhansk, and Kharkiv occupied government buildings and called for a referendum on secession from the Kiev regime, now led by President Petro Poroshenko and Prime Minister Yatsenyuk. NATO reported convoys of unmarked Russian troops, tanks, and heavy weapons crossing the border into Ukraine. Fighting intensified. Mykhailo Lysenko, the deputy commander of the Ukrainian Donbas Battalion, called it a full-scale invasion. In late August, U.S. officials said that up to 1,000 Russian troops were involved in combat. Russia denied the allegations. The U.S. and NATO decried Russian aggression and imposed stiff sanctions. Historian Andrew Basevich dismissed the scare talk about Russia wanting to re-establish the Soviet Empire and countered that Putin acted as would any U.S. president contemplating the absorption of a near neighbor into a hostile bloc of nations. Indeed, he acted much as had Dwight D. Eisenhower and John F. Kennedy when they assessed the implications of Cuba joining the Soviet bloc. Russia, Basevich noted, has an obvious and compelling interest in who controls Ukraine, even if few in Washington or in the editorial offices of the New York Times will acknowledge that reality. Full-scale fighting broke out in summer 2014 in the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine, where the Ukrainian army, backed by volunteer Islamic battalions, neo-Nazis, and other right-wing groups, confronted Russian-backed militias of the self-proclaimed People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, DNR and LNR. The New York Times reported in July 2015 that 30 different units were arrayed against the pro-Russian separatists. According to the Times' Andrew Kramer, the Ukrainian army, corrupt and underfunded, has largely been ineffective against the more heavily armed Russian-backed rebels. The Chechens were skilled fighters aided by Uzbeks, Balkars, and other from former Soviet republics. The right-wingers, many of whom had been on the front line of the violence directed against Yanukovych, included Right Sector, which, Kramer notes, was formed during last year's street protests in Kiev from a half-dozen fringe Ukrainian nationalist groups like White Hammer and the Trident of Stepan Bandera. Another, the Azov Group, is openly neo-Nazi, using the wolf's hook symbol associated with the SS. With fighting continuing to rage and the death tolls mounting, on February 12, 2015, leaders of Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany, as well as officials from the DNR and LNR, signed the 13-point Minsk II agreement mandating a ceasefire and removal of all heavy weapons from the front lines. Ukraine was obligated to enact constitutional reforms that provide for decentralization and give Donetsk and Luhansk a greater measure of local control. In exchange, all foreign armed formations were to be withdrawn, and Ukraine was to regain control of its borders. But the conflict remained frozen as the two sides disagreed about the sequencing of the required steps. Russian leaders knew that lowering of tensions in Ukraine was their only hope to get the West to lift sanctions. Paul Quinn Judge, a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group, explained that Russia is intensely frustrated by the lack of movement on the February 2015 Minsk agreement and has sought to put the onus for the lack of progress on Ukraine. The agreement is highly disadvantageous for Ukraine. Some key clauses, such as according the entity's special status, would be politically explosive, perhaps politically fatal, for President Petro Poroshenko. He has accordingly chosen to delay as much as possible. Moscow is turning up the heat. Under Obama, the U.S. provided military equipment and training to the Ukrainian Army and National Guard, but denied Ukraine lethal weaponry, realizing that such arms would only escalate the conflict and, even worse, might lead to war. Candidate Clinton broke with Obama on the issue, signaling that she would send such weapons. Trump not only challenged that view, his representatives stripped the plank supporting lethal weapons from the Republican platform. But that caution disappeared on December 2017, when the Trump administration authorized the sale of Javelin anti-tank missiles and sniper rifles, which Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee, approvingly described as defensive lethal arms. An unnamed senior congressional official told the Washington Post, "We have crossed the Rubicon. This is lethal weapons, and I predict more will be coming." The following March, the State Department formally approved the $47 million sale of weapons provided by Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. Ukraine has been in the U.S.-EU orbit for more than 4 years, during which conditions have gone from bad to worse, as increased military spending has only exacerbated Ukraine's problems with corruption. Neo-Nazis, led by the 3,000-plus-strong Azov militia, have almost free rein, with 20,000 marching in the streets of Kiev, wielding torches and shouting anti-Semitic slogans. In February 2018, the New York Times reported, "The problem of corruption has throttled the hopes raised in February 2014 by the ouster of Ukraine's notoriously corrupt, pro-Russian former president, Viktor F. Yanukovych. It has also left the country's dispirited Western backers and many Ukrainians wondering what, after two revolutions since independence in 1991, it will take to curb the chronic corruption." Among those on the take were President Poroshenko and his friends. Ivaras Abramovicius, who had resigned in protest after pushing unsuccessfully for reform, while serving as Minister of Economy and Trade, complained that conflicts of interest are so commonplace that you are no longer even shocked. They are all over the place. It is sad, depressing, and discouraging. Things got so bad that the IMF and EU stopped payment on more than $5 billion of assistance because of the delay in establishing a promised anti-corruption court. Putin blamed Western hubris for the impasse in Ukraine. In October 2014, he addressed the Valdai International Discussion Club in the southern resort town of Sochi and reminded participants, "They simply told us this is none of your business. Point, period. End of discussion." Instead of a comprehensive, but, I stress, civilized dialogue, it all came down to a government overthrow. They plunged the country into chaos, into economic and social collapse, into a civil war with enormous casualties. This happened after Yanukovych, Putin recalled, signed everything, agreed with everything. Why do it? What was the point? What is this? A civilized way of solving problems. Former U.S. Ambassador Matlock believed that Russia had a solid case in Ukraine. Matlock wrote, "Russians would argue, with some substance in the argument, that the U.S. is interested in territorial integrity only when its interests are served. American governments have a record of ignoring it when convenient, as when it and its NATO allies violated Serbian territorial integrity by creating and then recognizing an independent Kosovo. Also, by supporting the separation of South Sudan from Sudan, Eritrea from Ethiopia, and East Timor from Indonesia. So far as violating sovereignty is concerned, Russia would point out that the U.S. invaded Panama to arrest Noriega, invaded Grenada to prevent American citizens from being taken hostage, even though they had not been taken hostage, invaded Iraq on spurious grounds that Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction, targets people in other countries with drones, etc., etc. In other words, for the U.S. to preach about respect for sovereignty and preservation of territorial integrity to a Russian president can seem a claim to special rights not allowed others. Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes understood the Russian logic. Putin is not entirely wrong. We engaged in regime change around the world. There is just enough rope for him to hang us. Actually, there was more than enough rope to hang the United States when it came to ousting governments, including democratically elected ones, as we have shown time after sordid time throughout the book. Among those who applauded Putin's rebuke of the West was Mikhail Gorbachev. Speaking at a November 2014 Berlin symposium, commemorating the 25th anniversary of the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Gorbachev warned that the world was on the brink of a new Cold War. He explained, "The West, and particularly the United States, declared victory in the Cold War. Euphoria and triumphalism went to the heads of Western leaders. Taking advantage of Russia's weakening and the lack of a counterweight, they claimed monopoly leadership and domination of the world." He placed the blame for recent tensions squarely on the West, citing the enlargement of NATO, Yugoslavia, particularly Kosovo, missile defense plans, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and the list goes on. To put it metaphorically, a blister has now turned into a bloody, festering wound. Others also cautioned restraint. In an interview with Der Spiegel, Henry Kissinger reminded readers, "If the West is honest with itself, it has to admit that there were mistakes on its side. The annexation of Crimea was not a move toward global conquest. It was not Hitler moving into Czechoslovakia." Kissinger explained that Putin had just spent tens of billions of dollars on the Sochi Olympics in order to ingratiate himself with the West and develop closer ties. "So it doesn't make any sense," Kissinger reasoned, "that a week after the close of the Olympics, Putin would take Crimea and start a war over Ukraine. So one has to ask oneself, why did it happen?" Kissinger went on to answer his own question. "Europe and America did not understand the impact of these events, starting with the negotiations about Ukraine's economic relations with the European Union, and culminating in the demonstrations in Kiev. All these, and their impact, should have been the subject of a dialogue with Russia. Ukraine has always had a special significance for Russia. It was a mistake not to realize that." Such contextualization was rare in the U.S., where journalists and politicians, many of whom had cheered on the U.S. invasion of Iraq, now turned Russia's reannexation of Crimea and involvement in Ukraine into an excuse for full-throated demonization of Putin. Hillary Clinton compared his actions in Ukraine to Hitler's seizure of Poland and Czechoslovakia. Some said he ran a kleptocracy, even accusing him of being the richest man on the planet. Others blamed him for the murder of journalists and critics, a list that included Alexander Litvinenko, Anna Politkovskaya, Boris Nemtsov, Sergei Magnitsky, Natalia Estimerova, Sergei Yushchenkov, Paul Klebnikov, Stanislav Markelov, and Anastasia Baburova, among others, many of whom were fierce opponents of Putin and his government. Putin and his supporters bitterly deny such accusations, and as Nina Ognianova, the coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists, Europe and Central Asia program, acknowledged, there is no evidence linking Putin to the murders. The Washington Post's Adam Taylor found it more likely that individuals loyal to him acted without his knowledge or permission, or that another group in the complicated, multifaceted world of modern Russia was behind the acts. Those other groups, according to Brookings Institution Russia expert Fiona Hill, were often local and regional governments and leaders. Regional journalists, she notes, have been the target of most of the violence, not national ones. Ognianova contends that journalists covering sensitive areas can be slain with impunity in Putin's Russia. In the case of Politkovskaya, however, Putin argued that killing her did the Russian government more harm than good. "Murdering such a person," he insisted, "certainly does much greater damage from the authorities' point of view, authorities that she strongly criticized, than her publications ever did." Such reasoning might make sense after the fact, but it didn't deter Saudi leaders from ordering the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Congress passed House Resolution 758, strongly condemning Russian actions. Leading the opposition was Ron Paul, who characterized the resolution as 16 pages of war propaganda that should have made even neocons blush, if they were capable of such a thing. The EU also imposed sanctions on Russia, but ones that didn't bite as hard as those imposed by the U.S. Some countries, including Hungary, feared the EU as being unnecessarily confrontational. While the sanctions, combined with plummeting oil and gas prices, were taking a severe toll on the Russian economy, Putin was busy strengthening economic ties with Turkey, Iran, India, China, and other countries in late 2014. But Russia weathered the storm. By early 2015, the Western media was conceding that the U.S. effort to weaken and isolate Russia had failed. In an extraordinary piece from Moscow in May 2015, New York Times correspondent David Herzenhorn reported on Secretary of State John Kerry's visit to Sochi, 3 days after the U.S. tried to get other nations to join it in boycotting Russia's enormous annual Victory Day celebration. The Times recognized that Obama's year-long effort to isolate Russia and its renegade president, Vladimir V. Putin, portraying him as a lawless bully atop an economically failing, increasingly irrelevant petrostate, had failed. According to the Times' analysis, Mr. Obama led the charge by the West to punish Mr. Putin for his intervention in Ukraine, booting Russia from the Group of Eight economic powers, imposing harsh sanctions on some of Mr. Putin's closest confidants, and delivering financial and military assistance to the new Ukrainian government. In recent months, however, Russia has not only weathered those attacks and levied painful counter-sanctions on America's European allies, but has also proved stubbornly important on the world stage. That has been true especially in regard to Syria, where its proposal to confiscate chemical weapons has kept President Bashar al-Assad, a Kremlin ally, in power, and in the negotiations that secured a tentative deal on Iran's nuclear program. Putin, the Times acknowledged grudgingly, seems to be emerging on top, if not as an outright winner in his most recent confrontation with the West, then certainly as a national hero, unbowed, firmly in control, and having surrendered nothing, especially not Crimea, his most coveted prize. The ruble had rebounded after a sharp fall and oil prices had stabilized. When it came down to it, Obama realized he needed Russian help to achieve his nuclear deal with Iran, which was a higher priority for him, and that Russia was willing to sacrifice much more for Ukraine than the U.S. was. 1 week later, the New York Times carried an equally revealing article titled, "Russia Casts a Shadow Over European Meeting," that began, "Prime Minister David Cameron of Britain showed up hours late, but the absentee who really mattered, and haunted all discussion during the 2-day meeting of leaders from Europe and former Soviet lands, was President Vladimir Putin of Russia, who had not even been invited. The meeting was called to advance the European bloc's Eastern Partnership with 6 former Soviet territories, but pressure from Putin had made them all back away. EU officials declared the meeting a success, and Times reported, simply because leaders had managed to stand still and not lose further ground. Many Europeans thought Western punishment of Russia was getting out of hand. More than 60 prominent Germans from across the political spectrum, including former Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, rejected the U.S. confrontation with Russia and called for a new policy of European-Russian détente. Russians remained defiant despite economic hardship. In March 2016, Putin's approval rating stood at 73%, down from 83% a year earlier, but still the envy of Western politicians. Another poll, released 5 months later by state pollster VTSIOM, found that 2/3 of Russians wanted a strong hand to maintain stability, while only 1/4 thought political freedom and democracy were indispensable under all circumstances. The U.S. and its allies poured time and money into Ukraine, but their efforts yielded scant results as conditions deteriorated. No one was more invested in seeing Western democracy succeed in Ukraine than Vice President Joseph Biden. Between 2014 and the time he addressed the Ukrainian parliament in December 2015, he had spoken by phone with President Poroshenko 40 times, and with Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk 16 times, and visited 4 times. Other U.S. officials and members of Congress visited more than 100 times in 2014 alone. In their minds, wresting Ukraine from Russia was almost on a par with liberating a country like Hungary from Soviet grasp in the 1950s. but the situation had turned bleak by late 2015. Reuters noted that, despite intense efforts by the White House, the project is now in danger of unraveling, as divisions inside the ruling coalition are growing and many of the reforms are stalled. If the leaders fail, Reuters observed, it will be a deep embarrassment to Washington, the EU, and the IMF, which sacrificed relations to Russia to support these people. Reuters further detailed the hopelessness of the situation. War against the separatists killed thousands of people and made hundreds of thousands homeless. State coffers were empty, the currency in freefall, and business and homes still dependent on Russia for energy supplies. Soviet-era industries were held by politically connected insiders. Corruption had become entrenched. On top of this, the IMF was keeping Kiev afloat, but demanded a restructuring of its debt and a swathe of reforms to its finances, politics, and industry, which the Ukrainians were resisting. After reading the Riot Act to Poroshenko in private, Biden laid out a series of steps the parliament needed to take to eliminate the stultifying corruption and implement political reform measures. But Biden's credibility was compromised by the fact that his son Hunter had recently become director of a Ukrainian gas company. Award-winning journalist Robert Parry, who had worked tirelessly for years to combat false historical narratives, was deeply troubled by the media distortion of what was occurring in Ukraine. He wrote sagaciously, "If you wonder how the world could stumble into World War III, much as it did into World War I a century ago, all you need to do is look at the madness that has enveloped virtually the entire U.S. political media structure over Ukraine, where a false narrative of white hats versus black hats took hold early and has proved impervious to facts or reason." The Maidan shifted a gear, Ben Rhodes told The Atlantic's Julia Ioffe. Putin went on offense after the Maidan. The gloves were off and away. To Putin, Ukraine was such a part of Russia that he took it as an assault on him. Ioffe similarly connected the dots. Regime change in Libya and Ukraine led to Russia propping up Bashar al-Assad in Syria. Not one more is how John Finer, former Secretary of State John Kerry's chief of staff, characterizes Putin's approach in Syria. It also led inexorably to Russian meddling in the U.S. election. Russia would show the U.S. that there was more than one regime change racket in town. In The World as It Is, a memoir of the Obama White House, and in an interview with Time, Rhodes elaborated on the connection between U.S. actions in Ukraine and Russian intervention in the 2016 elections. Rhodes explained, "Putin, I think, interpreted the protest that ousted the Ukrainian president as the Americans coming into Russia. He thought we were behind those protests. He drew no distinction between Ukraine and Russia. I'd sit in the Oval Office and listen to these endless conversations, where Putin would steer everything back to his view that we had overthrown a democratically elected government in Yanukovych. He was going to punch back. That's when we started to see fake news, and we started to see the release of intercepted communications to suit Russia's political narratives. So all of that set the stage for what happened in our election. You cannot understand the Russian meddling in the 2016 election without understanding the Russian response to Ukraine. It was all the same tools. It was information warfare, essentially, that they had developed in Ukraine, just set loose in the United States." U.S. actions in Ukraine certainly infuriated Russian leaders and may indeed have contributed to Putin's decision to intervene in Syria. But Rhodes neglects to mention the other obvious factors that spurred Russian military involvement. For Russia, Syria's Assad was an ally who asked for Russian help. Russia had already watched the U.S. topple government after government in its effort to remake the political map of the Middle East. It refused to sit back and let Washington repeat that process in Syria, a missing piece that the neocons, who had already done so much to destabilize the region, still drooled over. And Russia, as Putin stated repeatedly, had good reason to be concerned about U.S.-backed Islamic extremists taking over Syria. The distance from Damascus to Moscow was a little more than 2,000 miles, It was almost 6,000 miles from Damascus to Washington. The actual distance to Grozny, Chechnya, in Russia's Muslim south is 850 miles. And just less than 7% of Russia's population, including its most restive communities, happened to be Muslim. For Putin, concerns about the spread of terrorism were real. Trump's decision to withdraw, one that was years overdue, raised the usual hackles in the media. Certainly, his method of announcing and implementing it reeked with Trumpian incompetence. Announcing by Twitter, failing to inform U.S. allies, and repudiating expert advice. But pulling the 2,000 U.S. troops, who were there without clear mission or legal authorization, made perfect sense, as did cutting troop levels in Afghanistan. But the media outcry was deafening. The free American press hit a new and embarrassing low. It got so bad, so vituperative, that veteran NBC News reporter William Arkin, a respected journalist who had also written for the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, and Washington Post, felt compelled to resign. He'd finally had it, with a media so craven that it failed, he noted, to say a critical word about national security leaders and generals who produce nothing that resembles actual